This is The Guardian.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnen? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
That was an incredible election result, a historic result.
Mr. Prime Minister, congratulations, what a hell of a victory. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. President.
It isn't a Conservative Party in that sense, and so it should no longer exist.
The country needs the Conservative Party right now to provide a strong opposition.
We've managed over a number of years to persuade people to steal our policies, and that's a really good idea.
You look at the chaos going on in the continent, particularly in France. You look at the chaos likely ahead in the United States, and suddenly, for once, for the first time in many of our lives, actually Britain looks like a little haven of peace and stability.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
So have you recovered yet, Pippa?
Well, I think I'm in kind of autopilot. I'm just keeping going because you have to. Very British dictum, that, isn't it? You know, keep calm and carry on. And I'm anticipating a moment at some point where I just like collapse and heave and pass out. Hopefully not when I'm at work. But
can you imagine that? I mean, we had it pretty bad over the last few days and campaign trail straight into election night and then the new government. But can you imagine being Keir Starmer? I mean, you've had 6 weeks on the trail. He had quite an intense, I was with him just at the end. He had quite an intense final day of the campaign. And then I think he stayed up, he said.
Yeah,
he didn't get to sleep.
He was going to grab a couple of hours, apparently, at some point between the exit polls and, well, between his own count and later on. But no, that didn't happen.
And then Saturday morning, he has a cabinet and he's off to Washington next week.
I mean, the man's a machine.
He must be just exhausted. But here we are now, a few days into the Labour government. You know, one of the interesting things I think is that there have been some interesting appointments to the cabinet, but actually most of the cabinet jobs, and as we're starting to see, most of the top officials are exactly the same people that he had around him in opposition, right? There's no huge surprises yet.
No, and it's what they said we should expect, but I don't think we ever quite believed them because we're so used to being told one thing by advisors, politicians, and then something else happening. So, you know, I mean, we're naturally probably quite sceptical people, us journalists, but I think we've got increasingly so in the last few years with some of the shenanigans that we've seen in government. And so it's actually been quite surprising that, and it goes back beyond the election, actually, to take the example of the manifesto launch. We were all desperately trying to find out, as you'll remember, what the sort of, you know, the rabbit out the hat rabbit would be for the manifesto and what the big announcement would be. And Labour people kept saying to us, look, there's not going to be a big announcement. We've already set out our missions for growth. It's all going to be in there. Yes, we'll present it in a certain way, but you know what we're going to do. And we thought, nah, that can't be right. That can't be right. And then lo and behold, there was the manifesto launch and it was exactly what they said they were going to do. We've seen it a few times since, most recently, as you say, with the shadow cabinet then transferring over wholesale to the cabinet and sitting round that table, that picture of them. Everybody there was in Keir Starmer's shadow cabinet once again doing what they said they were going to do. And I think that this is probably quite illustrative of how he will run his government. As one of his shadow cabinet ministers, now cabinet minister, said to me the other day, he's no drama Starmer. He doesn't want the sort of like performative, over-the-top politics, us all speculating about what's about to be announced, what's about to happen. He just wants to get on and do things that work. And that, in his view, I think is the way that he will start the very difficult, very arduous process of beginning to restore trust in the British political system and the politicians.
Do you think it can last, though? I mean, it's fine for now when you're at the top of your popularity, you've just come into government, you probably don't need to be dazzling everybody with shock announcements. But 2 years in, his popularity will undoubtedly be lower. He'll have a load of papers who didn't back him in the first place really on his back. We'll see where the Conservative Party is at that stage. But he'll be under a lot of pressure from his own side to kind of do something different, to to kind of set the agenda to probably have a reset at some point. Do you think he can kind of see this out 5 years of no drama?
Well, I think he wants to try and keep the current team in place if he can, if they're delivering. That's the key point. And if they're not delivering, then presumably he'd want to change them. But quick answer to your question, no. I mean, I don't think he's going to be able to see that through. I don't mean with cabinet reappointments. I mean, sort of like the style, the sort of the need to feed the beast, so-called feed the beast of the media. I think he'll be under an awful lot of pressure. And the reality is that, you know, we're sitting here talking about whether there's a honeymoon period. I mean, I don't think he's going to get a honeymoon period at all. I think already over the weekend, even among some of those papers that were ostensibly supporting Labour going into the election, we've seen quite a lot of criticism about some of his early remarks in that press conference. We've seen quite a lot of scepticism about what he can deliver. And I think he's going to be, in that regard, on the back foot from the off. And, you know, he has time on his side. That's the one thing he does have. He's got 5 years to try and make a difference. But they will be under a huge amount of pressure to try and change track and respond to events, as every political leader always is.
Yeah, well, we said that there were no surprises, but actually that's not quite true, is it? Because there were a few surprises and quite interesting appointments they were too. We had James Timpson from the Timpson Empire coming in as probation minister. We had Richard Hermer, a very well-respected human rights barrister in KC, coming in as Attorney General. And Patrick Vallance, whom people will remember, of course, from the COVID pandemic, coming in as a science minister. This starts to look a bit Brownite, a little bit government of all the talents, if people remember that, is... And I don't think it worked very well for Gordon Brown from memory. He brought in people like Digby Jones, who was, you know, constantly disloyal.
So he was
quit.
Chair of the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry. And he was supposed to, obviously, to show that the Brown government was, you know, on the side of business.
Right.
But he was in for what, a few months? And he was criticising the government policy left, right and centre. And eventually he went to the independent.
And he was, obviously, he was brought in as a Labour minister. And there was always a question about whether he was ever a Labour supporter or whether he'd ever voted Labour. Now, I don't know about James Timpson or Richard Hermer and Patrick Vallance. I don't know whether they're Labour supporters or not, but it kind of shows you, doesn't it? It's fine to have this government of all the talents. You know, if it works, that's great. But it's much more difficult to control people like that than your own party loyalists.
Yeah, and there's also the inevitably, and we saw this again over the weekend, people will ask questions about things that those individuals have said or done in the past. Now, Patrick Vallance, who was chief scientific advisor throughout the pandemic, is a pretty well-known figure in the UK. So probably we've trawled over his thoughts and views on things before. So I can't imagine him throwing up too many problems on that front for Keir Starmer. But Timpson, James Timpson, is a really interesting one because his role currently, as well as running the Timpson's shoe empire, which obviously has really interesting approach to its employees and employs a lot of people who've been through the criminal justice system, for example, he is also chair of the Prison Reform Trust and has some very bold ideas about what you need to do to improve the criminal justice system. Obviously, prisons are at a breaking point. That's one of the urgent things in Keir Starmer's entry, is that he's going to have to make a decision about whether to go ahead with early release. And one of the things that Starmer's already been asked about with Timpson is his an interview he did recently in which he suggested that of all the people that are currently in prison, only a third should actually be there.
Yeah.
His focus, of course, being on rehabilitation and sort of a nod to the extremely high reoffending rates currently, looking at organisations like his company, which have managed to sort of take people and sort of give them a meaning in life again, a job, a salary, hope. He's got a very different way of doing things. And Starmer will have to navigate some of, you know, these ministers' own private views with actually what his government is going to be able to deliver. Because you can just see the right-wing press going for front pages saying, oh, you're going to release all prisoners onto the streets.
Yeah, well, this is where we see the real Keir Starmer, isn't it? Because now he has to actually make these decisions one way or another. Now he's in government. You know, for a long time in opposition, he was able to kind of fudge questions like this, either be vague or deflect attention or get attention back onto the Conservatives. Now he actually has to make choices and people are going to be able to hold him accountable for those and really see where his instincts lie. Talking of which, it was also interesting, I thought, some of the old Blairites and Brownites he brought back, because it's not just these outsiders who come back into government. It's a selection of people that, you know, listeners might remember from a couple of decades ago, people like Alan Milburn, Uber Blairite, I think it's fair to call him.
Absolutely.
Jackie Smith, former Home Secretary, Douglas Alexander, Uber Brownite. I think we could probably call him. I mean, look, the Brownite, Blairite labels don't matter as much as why is he bringing these people back from, you know, Labour's glory days, as it were. These are not, they're certainly not people from the left of the party, are they?
No, but they're also people that have reputations for delivery. And Starmer knows he doesn't have time, much time, to prove to people that his government can actually make a real impact on their lives. And take the example of the NHS, for example. That's one of those areas where we've heard from voters in the run-up to the election that they care about most. They really hate the fact they can't get a GP appointment. You know, there's too many people, millions of people on hospital waiting lists. There's real issues with finding a dentist. And there's obviously, on top of it all now, right now, there's the issue of the junior doctor strike, which have to be resolved. Now, Alan Milburn, he was health secretary, obviously, under Tony Blair. And during that period, he started doing things like bringing the private sector and the marketplace and competition into the NHS, which was, you know, ideologically quite difficult for the left to get a grip on. His aim was, and Blair's aim, in fact, was to make it work, to be pragmatic about it. But of course, as we found out with things like foundation hospitals, you know, huge amounts of money were wasted and they didn't necessarily achieve the results that they were intended to. So he himself is quite a controversial figure, but shows that Starmer is interested in new, big, bold ideas that could actually have a transformative effect.
He also, I think, has worked in the private healthcare sector and, you know, he has had financial interests among, you know, private healthcare providers. And that has been very controversial among a lot of people in Labour. And I think they'll be looking at that appointment and what he does very, very carefully. But, you know, Starmer, I think, will have appointed most of his ministers by early this week. He is spending Monday doing a Four Nations tour, spending some time in Scotland, and also, I think, meeting the regional mayors and talking about growth. So that's going to be busy enough. And then he flies to Washington on Tuesday.
That's right. And I will be on that plane with him, along with probably half the lobby. But it's Starmer's first overseas visit. It was always going to be where whoever ended up in Downing Street would be going, because it's the 75th anniversary for NATO. So it's a big summit, all the NATO leaders. And it kind of also helps that it's in Washington, because I imagine that Labour will be pushing pretty hard to try and get his first bilateral meeting with Joe Biden, the US president. Now, Biden doesn't generally like doing bilats at international summits in Washington, when people come to him, doesn't want to show favouritism, I suppose. But you'd imagine that given the so-called special relationship and given that Keir Starmer has just been elected, that he could find that the door of the Oval Office is pushed open for him. But NATO will be obviously about underscoring Britain's support for Ukraine and Volodymyr Zelensky going forward. On the election campaign, we've already heard Starmer commit to multi-year settlements for funding support for Ukraine. But it's also his opportunity to kind of show the rest of the world that Britain, despite the fact it's under new leadership, is committed to the military alliance, is committed to national security, and is committed to global defence. And, you know, we've heard a lot about that internally. It's one of the areas we've talked about a lot, about how the Labour Party's transformed from the era from Jeremy Corbyn, who obviously wasn't a fan of NATO, to Keir Starmer. And Starmer will be wanting to underline that on the world stage, making it clear that Britain is a reliable, stable partner, will continue to be that, and that the change of leadership at the top of government doesn't actually make any difference in that regard. It's his first chance to sort of show the world who he really is.
You were talking about the potential for a bilateral with Joe Biden. I think it'd be really interesting to see whether or not that happens. Biden, as you know, it doesn't need saying, is at a real low point. I mean, maybe the question is even whether Starmer wants a bilateral with a president who might not even be their candidate in a few weeks' time, but presuming he does, I imagine Biden will actually want some of that stardust of the recent election win to rub off on him.
There was that amazing clip, wasn't there, of the call.
Yeah.
All leaders, when they come in, will have like a list of international leaders that they need to take calls from to, to get their congratulations and to sort of, you know, just have that first contact with them. The US is always top of the list. It was this time as well. And unusually, Kieran, what happened?
Well, I reported in the US and I know how carefully controlled the White House is about what they say about conversations that the president has with other world leaders.
Private conversations.
Private conversations. You usually just get a one or two paragraph readout. I mean, a little bit similar to what we normally get from Downing Street as well. But, you know, it is very straight down the line. But this conversation, they recorded it on the UK side and posted it as a social media clip. And it was a really, really revealing little bit of footage, which I think we've got, right?
This is the White House Situation Room, getting to connect Prime Minister Starmer to President Biden. You are now connected to Air Force One.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Prime Minister, congratulations. What a hell of a victory. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's been a long night and day. I've been busy appointing my cabinet during the course of this afternoon. So thank you very much for your congratulations. And fortuitously, we will see each other next week. I'm very much looking forward to seeing you in Washington and having the opportunity, obviously, to sit down properly.
I'm looking forward to it as well. There's no doubt that under your leadership, our two countries are going to continue our special relationship. We're working together just about every issue, supporting Ukraine, managing the competition with China, advancing cooperation in the Indo-Pacific with AUKUS.
Firstly, the special relationship is obviously the bedrock, always has been, for, you know, our defence, for our security and prosperity, which obviously is central to our missions for government.
So, you know, the fact that the White House presumably gave permission for that, and the fact that that was allowed to happen, and essentially that clip really portrays Keir Starmer on the same level as Joe Biden and talking together as equals. That just shows you the UK's got some clout at the moment. And yeah, so maybe that tells us that the White House is open to just pushing the boundaries a little bit more.
And it is interesting as well that Starmer got out of it was the commitment to the special relationship, which we all obsess about over here. And, you know, in the States, they're much more sort of, hey, we've got special relationships, lots of relationships with lots of different countries.
And Biden particularly doesn't like talking about the special relationship. I don't know if you remember this. When he was running for election, there was a BBC reporter who doorstepped him and said, you know, Mr. Biden, a comment for the BBC. And he turned around and he said, BBC, I'm Irish.
Yeah.
that was kind of used to epitomize his approach to transatlantic relations for a long time.
Yeah. And we've also obviously had Justin Trudeau, very close to the States, talking about their close relationship, and indeed Emmanuel Macron as a transatlantic rival for the special relationship. But Biden did say those words, that he looks forward to further strengthening the special relationship with the UK. So that would be a big kind of like box ticked off in sort of British foreign policy goals for the new Labour administration.
But you're going to be there, right? So tell us what you're hoping to get out of it, what you think it might be like. What are these trips with Downing Street to the US?
Well, one thing I know for sure, and of course we don't know yet whether that bilat is going to take place, but one thing I know for sure is that if it does, it'd be very different from the last bilat
That like?
So I was in Washington in September 2021 with Boris Johnson. I've subsequently been to the States with Liz Truss, although she was, that was to New York for the UN General Assembly, and Rishi Sunak didn't actually get an invite to the White House, probably because Biden was over a couple of times and he saw him here at summits here. But Boris Johnson was the last British Prime Minister to be invited to the White House. And normally what happens to these things is that there'll be a couple of media from each side, so from the US side and from the UK side, a camera, a photographer, a stills photographer, and maybe a producer or reporter in there. And the two leaders sitting in their armchairs will sort of say a few words about how much they're looking forward to working together, a bit about the sort of their shared priorities and goals, all that sort of thing. And then they're whisked away and, you know, it all moves on. And we were told that it wouldn't be a press conference, so we weren't going to get the opportunity to have the two men standing behind the podiums to fire any questions that we wanted to at them. Now, I guess I should explain that the backdrop to all of this, and you'll know this well, Kieran, having worked in Washington, the backdrop to all of this is that the British press is way less more deferential to their leaders than the Americans are. The Americans will stand up when their leader arrives at the podium.
Yeah.
They will refer to them as Mr. President. It's all very polite and deferential. I always think partly because he is, of course, the head of state. And maybe if the king arrived at one of our press conferences, we might treat him
a little bit
differently.
I don't know if I would.
Maybe not. Anyway, but probably Your Highness, Your Majesty. I don't even know what the technical term is supposed to use. Anyway, Boris Johnson was neither of those things. And we weren't going to get a press conference. But what we did get was Downing Street somehow managing, I think at Boris Johnson's behest, a former journalist, remember, to get the whole travelling press pack into the Oval Office, which is actually much bigger than you think it is. It's much higher. The lighting was terrible, though. It's certainly not what it looks like on West Wing. It was kind of almost strip lighting around the top. But yeah, a bit disappointing. Anyway, Boris Johnson and Joe Biden were sitting in their chairs. They did their sort of their remarks. It was all recorded. And the very controlling White House press operation was then ready to whisk us all out. But no, Boris Johnson started taking questions. And we, being the British press, started shouting out. Joe Biden, meanwhile, sitting back looking like he was enjoying it, but, you know, a bit bemused maybe, but seemed quite happy about it, certainly unfazed. And Boris Johnson and he both responded to questions. And then there was this moment where clearly the White House team were like, we've had enough. This is not what we agreed. And they started hollering at the top of their voices, four or five people, get out the Oval Office, in order to drown out our questions. The few American reporters there are getting increasingly pissed off by the whole thing because they were obviously behaving themselves. And we were pretty much sort of manhandled en masse out the door. I'm amazed it didn't actually end up with some sort of major diplomatic incident.
Yeah, well, from my memory of reporting on the Biden White House, Joe Biden was always reasonably relaxed about talking to reporters off the cuff, but his press team absolutely hated it because that's when he would make his famous gaffes. So he would do these press conferences or speeches, which would go absolutely fine. And then he'd linger for a question or two at the end and then say something he really shouldn't have said. So his press team was so aggressive about getting him out of the room or getting the reporters out of the room at the end because they knew that's when trouble was going to happen.
Well, I think they may have learned their lesson from last time. Yeah. So we'll see what sort of access we get. But of course, while I'm in Washington, there's plenty going on back in London and at Westminster as well, isn't there? It's not business as usual, so we won't be seeing Prime Minister's question time, but that's because there's a few formalities that they need to get through first. First of all, the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, is expected to be re-elected on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we'll have several days of MPs being sworn in, where they come and they take their oath and officially, technically become members of Parliament. It's pretty daunting prospect because there's 334 new MPs this time out of a total 650.
That's incredibly high,
which
isn't
is a
it?
Huge number. So there's going to be a lot of people wandering around saying, you know, where's the canteen? Where do I do this? How do I get my pass? Why no Wi-Fi, you know, before they even get to the sort of the serious business of government. Somebody said the other day that it was going to be a bit like Freshers Week.
Yeah.
So slightly chaotic. But you'll be here, obviously, while I'm away covering all of that.
And meanwhile, while all of these new MPs are finding their feet, the Tory party is trying to pick itself up off the floor and pitched really straight into a leadership election. I think Victoria Atkins and Robert Jenrick were both on the shows on Sunday, just talking down the chances of having a quick leadership election. And this is something I'm going to be quite interested in. I mean, it sounds techie, but I think it's really important how long the Tories decide to take over their leadership contest, because there are lots of people in the party who say, take our time, have 6 to 9 months, let us properly have a conversation about where the party is going, how to deal with the threat of reform, how to deal with the voters we've lost to Labour, maybe let some kind of newer candidates that we've not thought of before come to the fore, which is all fine. But I remember when Labour decided to do something similar in 2010, and it pretty much went disastrously wrong because they spent ages in this lengthy leadership contest, which was full of internal drama. Obviously, you had the two Miliband standing against each other, which gave us enough drama. Meanwhile, the Tories were making absolute hay, starting to announce policies, rolling out a load of economic policies in particular. And George Osborne and others just spent that entire time saying, Labour is to blame for the economic mess that we're in, and we're going to have to make steep public sector cuts because of what they've done. And Labour was not able to respond to that because it was so busy dealing with its own internal crisis.
And the narrative was already set. And we started, very early days, obviously, we started seeing that from Labour already. They're talking about, they've had announcements, all these ministers going into their new departments, talking about how broken everything is.
Yes.
And, you know, I think we'll hear a lot of that in the weeks to come. It's broken. We're going to have to, you know, it's going to take us time, but we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to rebuild. Things are in a terrible state. We're going to need time to do it. And I think their hope is that that narrative will stick. People will think, God, Labour needs time because things were so bad and it's the Tories' fault. And there won't be anybody really that will be able to sort of speak for the Tories going forward to respond to that. Rishi Sunak, we understand, is going to stay in place. Yeah. Although, interestingly, when gave his speech when he left Downing Street, he suggested that he would be in place while the process for the leadership contest was established. We got press releases from CCHQ Tory headquarters over the weekend, which suggested he'd actually be in place over the course of that campaign. Oh, so staying on as a caretaker leader. Yeah. So we're not quite yet sure how that's going to play out, but whether he will feel, given he's the past, not the future now,
yeah,
in a position to really respond in a way that the party might need him to.
I mean, my assumption is there has to be a caretaker. I mean, I assume it would be someone like Oliver Dowden, unless Oliver Dowden wants to actually run himself for leader. They need somebody who's not going to run, who's just going to take the reins. And the main reason I assume that is because really the principal task of an interim leader in that position is to do the commons stuff, right? To represent the party in the commons. And of course, the centerpiece of that is PMQs. Now, can you imagine PMQs between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, but their places are swapped over? I mean, Rishi Sunak would have absolutely no authority. He wouldn't be able to get his backbenchers going. He wouldn't be able to land a blow. He's just lost an election to this man.
People might feel sorry for him, I suppose. But it is going to be brutal. I mean, there's going to be a lot of this, isn't there, already over the weekend of sort of getting your head into the space of Labour being government. I mean, a very sort of like basic level in our day-to-day reporting. I was on the phone to somebody over the weekend about Labour's logistics. Still calling them Labour rather than the government. I need to change that. And they were saying, the PM's doing this and then the Chancellor's doing that and blah, 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 blah. And I was sitting there. My instinctive thought was, Jeremy Hunt, Rishi Sunak. And I was like, no, of course it's not. Of course it's not. It's going to take us a while to get used to. So actually, maybe if it is Rishi Sunak versus Keir Starmer, it's familiar in some ways, but it'd be very odd seeing them because they'll all swap sides in the House of Commons chamber as well.
Yeah.
But the Tories, of course, will not just have a leadership contest to contend with. There have been several Conservative politicians over the last few days, both in speeches after losing their seats at the counts or writing pieces in the papers or even on social media that have suggested that, as we have talked about before, that it's actually an existential crisis for the Conservative Party. Marcus Fish, the former Tory MP for Yeovil, said over the weekend that the Tories were dead. And that is not just because they've been reduced to this rump of 121 MPs. It's also about who else is in Parliament. And of course, there will be five Reform MPs arriving under Nigel Farage to sit on the benches next to the Conservatives. And they will be making a racket. And I don't just mean that they're going to be standing up and using every opportunity, whether it's in the Commons or on GB News or in the right-wing press, to sort of, have their say. They feel very hard done by that the fact that they got a similar vote share to the Liberal Democrats, who've ended up with over 70 MPs, and they've just got a small handful. That's the way our system works, right? Mm. Maybe there's arguments for changing it, but that's the way our system works just now. But they will be wanting to have as big a say as possible. And one thing we know about Nigel Farage is that he's very good at getting attention when he wants to. So parallel to this Tory leadership contest, or actually integral to this Tory leadership contest running, will be how they deal with the threat of reform on their right flank and whether they pitch to the right, as people like Suella Braverman want them to do, to sort of tackle them head on issues like immigration. Robert Jenrick, I suspect, falls into that camp as well. Or do they, as people like Penny Mordaunt warned when she lost her seat, stay the course, recognise that the centre ground of British politics is where elections are won or lost, as Labour has just proven, and withstand the sort of the attempt by Farage and by the right flank of the Tory party to kind of drive the centre of their politics further to the right. So it's definitely a huge moment beyond just who ends up leading the party.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, but I think this is the point at which the Conservatives have to decide what conservatism means. Mm. Does it mean what it has traditionally meant in this country? Low tax, less government, but essentially keeping things as they are, respect for institutions and not meddling in people's lives, and kind of in a lot of ways being a relatively moderate party? Or is it this much more aggressive right-wing form of conservatism that we've seen in other parts of the world? And, are they going to take a turn towards Trump, especially if Trump is on the march in the US? That would be very tempting for parts of the British Conservative Party to try and follow him down that track, I suspect.
But while all of this is going on, Labour will be concentrating on getting on and governing the country. And actually, they'll be quite happy in some ways to have the Tory party fighting over the future direction of the right in one corner. They'll be getting on with the issues that they say are important and that they promise to deliver on in the run-up to the election. And key to that is going to be growth. We're going to see Rachel Reeves deliver a speech about growth and how they're going to achieve that, not just making sure it's sustainable, but also making sure, crucially, that it's in all parts of the country. And that ties in with Keir Starmer's tour around the UK that you mentioned at the start, Kieran. And I think we'll start to see a bit more detail about how they will achieve that growth, how they'll pull that lever, with some detail on things like housing and planning other supply side reforms, which might not necessarily be the sort of thing you might expect to hear from a Labour administration. They'll have to characterise that quite carefully, I think, so that people don't start accusing them of Tory-lite, sugar rush, trust-lite policies. But nevertheless, they recognise the need for speed, really, when it comes to growth. And there's only certain ways that you can achieve that.
Well, on the planning side, they've obviously flagged this up way in advance. And I don't think anybody's going to be surprised if Labour does things like, reasserting the mandatory targets on local authorities to build a certain amount of houses, or make it easier for developers to build on the greenbelt. That's stuff they've told us they're going to do. But it's interesting that you're talking about them kind of moving on to Tory territory with that, because one thing I was writing about over the weekend, my colleague Richard Partington and I wrote a story saying that central to that planning review that I think Labour will now do is the former Tory planning minister, Nick Bowles, who defected from the Tory party to Labour a few months ago, and which was quite an eye-catching thing to do, and then introduced Rachel Reeves at a really important speech. So you could tell he was kind of quite central to their economic team. We're told that he will be consulted on the planning review and might even lead it as some kind of planning czar. Now, people close to Nick Bowles say, look, no decision's been made yet. But, you know, that's quite an interesting signal. And what Nick Bowles was famous for in government was being, you know, the absolute deregulator when it came to planning. He really thought that you just needed to get out there and get building and not have all these things that could stand in the way in the British planning system, which is, you know, pretty sclerotic, to be honest. And so, you know, if he is the one who's going to take that on, that tells you what direction they're going to go in, I think.
So we'll be all over that, Kieran, myself and the rest of the Guardian team, and all over everything else that the new Labour government is going to be doing in the coming week. But that's all from us for now. So please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. We'll be back on Thursday with me in Washington and Kieran in Westminster. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.